Well, good afternoon and welcome to this class. I'll begin just a fraction early. The Churches of Christ Heritage Center is on the second floor of Payson Library, and we invite you to come take a look if you have time. We're open from 11 in the morning till 6 each afternoon, and it's a wonderful collection, and we change the exhibit all the time, and there's a lot of things spread out on the table for you to look at. This year, the Heritage Center is sponsoring four classes during the Bible lectures, and this is class number one. It's my first time, even though I directed this event for 30 years, I never had a track on restoration history. So this is really the first time in 33 years to try to pull together some classes and actually have a track on restoration history. So I have put two women historians today back-to-back in this room, and tomorrow John Wilson, and then I'll be the last one tomorrow. So there's four classes together. We haven't even started yet. Come on, you can sit down. These seats all up here are empty, and there's a couple empty in the middle, that empty seat there on the side. Thank you all for coming. The person who's going to teach this class is Dr. Loretta Honeycutt. She's a Pepperdine grad. She graduated in the class of 1992 in history. Then she stayed here to get her master's in 1994. Then she went to Georgetown University to finish her PhD in American history. And I can't remember when she came back to teach. She's been here a long time. But she wrote her PhD dissertation on the wife of Alexander Campbell. That's who you're about to hear about. And she had this book published by the University of Alabama Press, which is a pretty prestigious press, to publish your book. And usually these kinds of books sort of have limited interest, and they never go through another edition. Then she found out last year the book has done so well, the University of Alabama was bringing out a new edition, a paperback, of the book they published in 2001. But you're not getting the book, some of it. What you're getting is how much Lori has continued to research since she wrote the biography of Selina Campbell, and you're really getting what she's learned in the last 12 years or so, which deserves the second book. I mean, it's very fascinating who Selina Campbell was and how respected she was. So you're really getting, I mean, you ought to go buy the book, and that's great, but you're getting the last 12 years since the book.
The rest of the story.
It's very intriguing. So the actual title is, Alexander Campbell's Fellow Soldier, his own title for his wife. So our speaker at this hour is Dr. Loretta Honeycutt. Will you welcome her to this class?
Jerry is right that today's lecture is a lot focused on updating what I originally said about Selina Campbell in the book. I mean, I'm happy to say it's not that I said wrong things about her. It's more like I just undersold her. Because the reason I learned this is a couple of years ago I started working on my current project. In fact, if I'm a little rusty today, it's because I've been in the classroom for a year. I've been on sabbatical researching in the process of writing the global history of women in the Stone Campbell movement, which hopefully will be done soon, but it probably a year or two. So this is kind of updating my latest research on Selina Campbell. I kind of undersold her. I mean, just to give you an idea on how long it was since I've reviewed my Selina Campbell research when I pulled it all out recently, I realized that most of that research was still backed up on floppy disks. Wow, it has been a while. But I pulled it all out because I kept finding her again in all the materials I was looking through. Now looking globally. I had no idea she had a global presence, but more on that in a little bit. Other things I want to do in this presentation today, though, is use her as kind of a window into the movement, and in doing so, kind of introduce new ways of thinking about women and gender in the Stone Campbell movement. So partly this presentation today shows you kind of a snapshot of where I am right now in looking at women in the Stone Campbell, in the process of writing this book where I'm trying to bring it all together. You know, who are the women that were influential? What did they do? How should we think about them? And I also want to kind of suggest ways that women's influence on the Stone Campbell movement can be measured using her as an archetype, using Selina Campbell as an archetype, because she really works quite well in setting a pattern for women in many ways, because she had her finger in so many pies that in just looking at her life, I can say so much about women in the movement. Now, here, I included these two pictures here. Here is her as a young woman, probably near the time of her marriage to Alexander Campbell. She was 26 when she married him. And then here, much later in their life, in the 1850s, And you'll see some other pictures of her as we go along. I kind of threw a little bit of those in there. I do want to say also, in general, this presentation is more of an overview. And those of you who want more detail, you can kind of be in prayer that I can finish that book soon. You'll get to see more. Okay, so to make a few observations about gender in the early Stone Camel movement, I'm mainly going to be looking at the Churches of Christ perspective in a way, the more kind of conservative part of the movement. And in part, the reason I'm doing that, you know, is because of the audience here. Most of you probably come from that part of the movement. But also because that's the one that we don't have as much information published about, and there's much more to be done there. Now, basically, gender in the Stone Camel movement was an inescapable part of the church experience in the 19th century, and of course, as it is today. It's a key part of the church experience. Let me tell you what I mean by that. In the 19th century, it was even spatially a part of how you would have experienced worship. Men and women generally sat on separate sides during worship, particularly before the Civil War. After the Civil War, you see that disappear fairly quickly. Socially, you know, men were groomed for leadership, you know, for some kind of public role in the church, whereas women were more groomed for motherhood and marriage. Now, this probably doesn't surprise you, but I guess the more important observation I want to make about that is everybody knew their place or role. It's not often questioned. I sometimes liken it to, you know, if you're going to study gender around us, it's sometimes like a fish studying water. You're just so in it. It's everywhere around you. You can hardly imagine your life without it, because so much of our thinking is shaped by ideas we have about gender that we often can't even verbalize. Now, of course, theologically, there were clear ideas about women. Generally, it's going to be that women must be silent. I made the reference to 1 Timothy 2. Though there's great complexity in that that I don't have time to get into today, but generally this was the accepted idea. Women are not going to be in positions of authority. And then I threw in there perennially. What has really shocked me is that in every single year, in every single publication of our movement, and there were extensive publications, that was the major way of communication in the movement, is through the journals. Every year, every publication, they debate the role of women.
Really? Wow.
Every year. There's not a year. I can show you my list. I thought, I should make lists of the articles I need to see from each journal. And so I can see this now. I have a list of like 3,000 articles, you know, from the various journals. And it's every year, every journal. It's the unusual journal that it's not there. There may be a few, but not many. Now, I wanted to tie together a little bit just to give you some overview of gender in the Stone Camel movement. That this, the restoration theology of Martin Stone and Alexander Campbell was connected with Victorian gender norms in some important ways. And I wanted to make those observations to give us a foundation for looking at the issues. Okay, most of you are probably pretty familiar with Victorian gender norms. I mean, this is what's going to be going on in the 19th century in terms of general roles for men and women. Now, we like to talk about these as if they were universal, though in fact they mostly describe middle-class white families. You know, if you were a lower-class family, women had to work. You know, you didn't have much choice. Yeah. So we've got to keep that in mind. We can't overgeneralize. Yet, in many ways, this was an ideal of the culture. Now, whether or not it was reality is a whole other issue. Historians are still kind of debating that. Did the separate spheres actually exist in reality? Of course, the separate spheres part merely means that in a lot of the literature of the time, the gender roles were described very clearly that, you know, men would work outside the home or work. Women would be the matriarchs of the home, take care of raising the children, you know, motherhood, marriage for women, the workplace for men, they were the providers. Men then were the political leaders, the economic leaders. Women maybe the leaders of the family, you know, in the home anyway, they're the leader of the home. A role, by the way, that did give them some authority in the culture. But overall, the main idea is that women were not to be involved in politics. They did not vote. They didn't generally own property till later in the, although there are plenty of exceptions to that. But generally, it was men that would be the economic and political leaders. Now, you combine that with some of the influences on restoration theology, such as Scottish common sense realism, which, if I'm paraphrasing it very roughly, is, you know, the text just kind of says what it says. And everybody can understand it. It's common sense, you know, and it's literal. So, you know, women must obviously, I put that kind of in parentheses, obviously they should be silent. Of course, there's problems with that, too, because there's other scriptures that might indicate differently. But those tended not to, you know, come up in the conversation much, or they were explained away. So you have those two forces. Well, you add to that, because you got the gender norms shaping how gender is experienced in the Stone Campbell movement. You've also got their approach to theology. Add in another element. Most of the Churches of Christ were a part of, especially by the late 19th century, they were mostly Southern. There are some important exceptions to that, but there's a great influence of Southern culture on it. And in particular, after the Civil War, you have in the South a kind of anti-urban, anti-elitist mentality, sort of a feeling of being misused by the North, mistreated, and the North was largely urban in their mind and very elitist. And so a lot of times women's roles in the churches that were expanding in these northern churches where women were founding societies and leading them seemed to be kind of a northern thing. And so there was already a kind of built-in antipathy to all things northern. This is also where you had the big fancy churches with the big fancy organs, and that didn't. And so that, I think that contributed to the antipathy against instruments in the church as well. There's a cultural element. All of that. So feminism also becomes only for elite big city churches and not relevant to many of the smaller rural congregations. So really, I kind of argue, these three ideologies kind of reinforce each other and really undermine any perception of female leadership, that it should happen. Now, on the other hand, I say there was actually female leadership. We just often don't see it. And that is where my focus will go today. Where was that female leadership? What did it look like? All of these things kind of tell us certain things about it, but we'll get into a little more detail about where it did exist. Well, the approach I'm going to take to the material is looking at Stone Campbell women as what I call bridge leaders, a unique kind of leadership. Actually, I should say I don't call it that. I borrow that. And I got that model for female leadership from a text by a woman named Belinda Robnett. I read this for a class I taught on social history. Her focus was on women in the civil rights movement. And she was, and much like the civil rights, I thought there's a lot of parallels between the black civil rights movement and the Stone Campbell movement. And the main parallel is, you would think, if you're studying that movement, that only men led the movement, that only men did anything. When in fact, if you look at the black civil rights movement, that was very much not true. And she used this concept of bridge leadership first to apply to the women in the civil rights movement. And to describe it, she also termed it a grassroots leader. That's almost a synonym. Grassroots leadership. In other words, leadership that was behind the scenes, private, not in kind of the public face, behind the scenes, operating outside of structures and hierarchies. And of course, most, as she argues, of these bridge leaders, not necessarily all though, men can be a bridge leader too, most but not all, are women. So I'm going to take that concept of bridge leadership, define it a little more, and apply it to what were Stone Campbell women doing? The reality is that much as in Robnett's analysis of the Black Civil Rights Movement, she basically argues that women played a key role in building and sustaining the movement. It was women that recruited volunteers to be at rallies, to be at protests. It was they who developed loyalty among the followers of the Black Civil Rights Movement, encouraging them to make the sacrifices necessary. That was a dangerous enterprise, Black Civil Rights Movement in the 50s and 60s, and it was women who were often the first ones to experience the consequences of that. And I mean, to some extent, this isn't hard to convince you of, because you have, say, Rosa Parks and other, key names. But outside of Rosa Parks, can anyone else name a female activist, in the Black Civil? Well, there were many. And so I want to do the same with the Stone Campbell movement. What are the names? There's Selena Campbell, there'll be others. Well, to help you understand how I'm going to analyze how women were leaders, I'm going to contrast bridge leadership and kind of what I call traditional leadership, for lack of a better term. And I do that here in this chart a little bit. Here are some categories to help you understand what it looks like. In part, it's going to be about visibility. Again, a lot of times we don't know that women were leaders because we can't see it. Where do you find it? Well, a lot of the sources we have left over are, say, newspaper journals and things. Probably all of you, especially if you've been in the churches a long time, can think of times where women were leaders. But if you read some of the journals and newspapers, you might think they never were. But if you probably have experienced it in your own life, but you don't see it recorded anywhere. So it's not visible. That's because often it's private and behind the scenes, whereas traditional leadership is more public. We think of it as a public event. And, of course, bridge leaders tend to be mostly female, traditional leaders mostly male. Not exclusively, but mostly. I threw race in there, too, because I think it's really important to realize that. Even within the Stone Campbell movement, you had a number of black women who were very effective bridge leaders. It's very difficult to find information about them, but I'm unearthing a few tidbits here and there. And then in terms of their relationship to the institutions of the movement, and by institutions I would say things like churches, colleges, these are the institutions, maybe journals would be an important example. Bridge leaders are the ones that are kind of, they're unpaid, untitled, they're mostly outside of institutions. They're influential, but just not in authority, not in an official capacity. Whereas traditional leadership is more institutionalized. These are the paid people, the paid preachers, the elected officials, the titled people. They're very authoritative. Here's where it gets, I think, where you can really see it. Here are examples of people who probably exerted a lot of leadership. These preachers' wives, a big one. Ministry leaders, you know, I put that in quotation marks because often that was a way to get women into the church as, you know, providing leadership, but not calling them a preacher or a pastor or anything like that. I call mothers are a part of these bridge leaders because they evangelize the next generation. Sunday school teachers, I have found at least dozens, maybe hundreds of accounts where male preachers will basically say, I became a preacher because my Sunday school teacher, who was a woman, said that I could do this and encouraged me to do it and taught me the Bible. That was the foundation of my preaching today to these Sunday school teachers. I thought, you know, that means something. These were the women who were shaping the preachers. And then church founders. Women founded hundreds of churches, thousands maybe. And they did so by raising money to build churches. They did so by gathering together to worship and then saying, hey, we need a leader, feeling like women weren't enough. And they'd write off to a journal and say, could you send us a preacher? And then they would, and there you have church. Mm-hmm. And, it was women that were doing this. Anyway, so I find it kind of interesting, some of the spiritual and theological implications of bridge leadership. I don't know how to put this. This is still rumbling around in my brain a little bit, but I thought it was worth noting. The irony of female leadership in the church, it's often undervalued, but... you know, does female leadership have some Christ-like characteristics?
I think so.
You know, in a way. I mean, and by the way, this is not meant to in any way, you know, criticize male leadership in any way, which is critical, but I just find it interesting. It's often done in secret. People don't know. There's often no expectation of recognition or reward. Service is rendered by the lowliest. Here I have, just to tell you, scriptural models, the widow's mite. Here's an artist depiction of that. That was how a lot of women portrayed themselves. They found organizations, for instance, some of the early Stone Campbell churches called the Mite Society, where basically everyone was supposed to give whatever little they had. Sometimes it was as little as donating extra eggs from your chicken that somebody could sell and raise a little few pennies, you know, for the church or maybe for a missions cause later. And I'll tell you, from those very tiny little contributions, later on, women in the Stone Campbell would make millions. On those little tiny. Men went after the big numbers, and the women went after the little bitty ones. Everybody give a little. And we're generally more successful at it as a result. Okay. I thought I'd throw in there, for those of you not familiar with Selena Campbell, at least a little bit of detail about her, some interesting things about her. She was the daughter of British immigrants. Their names were Samuel and Anna Maria Bakewell. She was one of the earliest converts to Campbell's teachings, in part of the Brush Run Church. Later on, was one of the initial members of the second church, the Wellsburg congregation in Virginia. She probably did not have much education, from what I've been able to tell, not very formally educated, but had a very able mind. You'll see that if you look very closely at any of her writings. She was very widely read, could conduct a number of intelligent discussions about a lot of issues. And was a close friend of Margaret Brown Campbell, who was Alexander Campbell's first wife. In fact, in kind of an unusual thing, and this is where I can tell you lots of interesting stories. I don't want to spend too much time on that. There's a lot of other things to say. But so Margaret and Selena are friends, and Margaret knows she's dying. She has tuberculosis. And she tells Alexander he needs to marry Selena. And it gets even weirder. So he does do what his wife asks. And it seems to work out pretty well. From all I can tell, they did make a really good team. It worked out very well for them. On their 50th anniversary, they have this really weird ceremony. It's a really big deal. They hold this big dinner. The whole family's there. And this is his 50th wedding anniversary to Selena. Yeah. And he gives her, I guess, this special ring. And I guess it has two, it had like two locks of their hair together or something like that, and says, "Now I fully transfer my affection from my first wife to my second."
Oh,
oh, after 50 years?
Oh, no.
It was just really weird. But
that's weird.
It's just strange. How did she live with that? Ah, I sometimes try to put myself in her shoes. She was 26 when she married him, and he was almost 40. And a pretty prominent man by then. And on a little side note, Margaret Brown, by the way, was the daughter of one of the wealthiest men in the county. And you could say that but for Alexander Campbell's marriage to Margaret Brown, there might not be quite the Stone Campbell movement we have now, because basically she was his favorite daughter. Well, he only had one daughter, really, but he's still here. He really doted on her and gave Alexander Campbell his whole entire estate for a dollar. Mm-hmm. And made Alexander Campbell instantly the most wealthy man in the county, which opened a lot of doors to him. I mean, he eventually gets elected to the Virginia Constitutional Convention and a lot of things. But for his marriage to Margaret Brown, you know, there's a question of how things would have gone. I mean, you just don't know. Certainly he was a brilliant man, so could have made his money another way. But it's interesting to ponder that. Selina Campbell's also interesting because she lives for the entirety of the 19th century, practically. So you can really see a lot of change and evolution in her life as well. Okay. So I wanted to break down a little bit about how she functions as a bridge leader and kind of get in detail, using her as the archetype for how we can look at women in the Stone Campbell movement, particularly in this early era, the 19th century. And I came up with four categories of where we can see her as a bridge leader. She is a preacher's wife. This is one of the most important categories. I was astounded at the stories I read about preacher's wives. Because at this time, you didn't have what was called then a located ministry, where a preacher's hired by a church, paid by that church. They were expected to kind of make their own living, kind of preach on the side, or travel around, and maybe everybody give them a little bit of traveling money. So they tended to have to support themselves in one way or another. And since most of them were gone all the time, it really fell to their wives to do that. There are stories of, you know, women tilling their own soil while their husbands and sons are off preaching. They run the farm. You know, they handle everything. And you really couldn't be a very effective preacher without a wife that could handle all the stuff at home. She was going to be raising your children because they were off traveling. That was the typical lot of a preacher. And in fact, there's even an instance. This really was brought home to me by one of the early preachers. I think it was Samuel Rogers, but I can't remember for sure. In one of the early biographies, I ran across a line where he was told when his wife died that he should, a person from one particular congregation wrote to him and said, "Hey, we have a lot of wealthy families with daughters. You should come here and marry one of them, because then you could go out and have a really good preaching career." Basically, by get a rich wife so you can be a good preacher. That really made me think, oh, that's interesting. Yeah. Now, in Selina Campbell, this is where you can really see where I started to undersell her. I had no clue that she was an international author. When I expanded my research into Stone Campbell women looking internationally, I started finding articles by her. And indicating she was reading a lot of journals from abroad, from England, Australia, Canada, mostly the English-speaking areas, of course, which is where the movement took hold first, most evidently. And then she ends up writing articles for these publications and writing letters to the editors that they publish. We'll look in detail more about those later. She's also what I would call kind of the behind-the-scenes shaper of institutional structure. We'll look at some examples of what kind of institutions she's influencing. And in her own way, was a female evangelist. I'm seeing all the ways that women were evangelists during this time, and some of them are really fascinating. And she was very cognizant of her role as an evangelist. It was a very effective one as well in her own way. She did not believe women should preach in the pulpit. She was very, very clear about that. In fact, she even chastised women in England who started doing that. They published her chastisement in the British journals. I found that really interesting. I was like, wow, she was really involved in everything a lot more than I thought. People looked to her for support for that. But she saw a lot of other ways women could be very influential there. Okay, so looking at her as a preacher's wife, this is kind of interesting. In many ways, she's kind of the most extreme preacher's wife of the era in some respects, because she's, you know, married to one of the most, you know, or the most influential preachers. She's right up there. And in general, she provided some pivotal support for her husband's career. I already said, you know, her husband, as many other preachers were at the time, gone a lot. So she had to manage their farm, which was the largest one in the county. This is not a little dinky area. This is like hundreds of acres. I forget how many exactly. Very extensive. When Campbell died, his estate was worth $275,000 at the time, which was quite extensive. She also had to raise children. I think total they had something like 9 or 10 together, and he had a few from his, so a lot of children she's also raising. She managed all their household staff, nearly a lot of servants, and anyway, a lot of things going on. Another thing she had to do, though, is when he was home, it's not like it was a break for her, because then all the people came to see him by the hundreds. So hospitality was a key part of her role as a preacher's wife. She had to feed, house, and often even clothe all the visitors. Her dining room table sat 40, just to give you a sense. And luckily, she caught a break in the 1840s when her brother started operating a general store. So I copied part of her order to him. I see this kind of an order. She'd write him letters telling him what she needed. And I thought this was real insight. Look what she writes. 150 pounds of sugar, 40 or 50 pounds of feathers, 10 yards of linen, soup plates, butter plates, common bowls, oval dishes, sauce dishes, a dozen pans, 3 or 4 larger pitchers, a dozen dining plates, a dozen, just goes on, 5 or 10 pounds of ground pepper, and all the buckets you can spare. Just to get what she managed. And it turns out she was really good at it. I sometimes think about that. She came from a pretty impoverished family. They didn't have much wealth. And she gets thrust into this marriage, this really prominent man. And it's really amazing that she thrives as well as she did in marriage. And everybody says, when he dies, there are accolades to her about how well she did managing their property. And in fact, she was the one that managed it all. I didn't put this in the PowerPoint. I didn't want to overwhelm it too much, but there's also letters from Alexander to her that have survived, where he's giving her page after page of instructions. All the things she had to manage. I want this crop planted here, and this crop planted here, and this, and she managed all those moving pieces quite well. This is their home, by the way, right? The Campbell Mansion, which you can still visit. Now, her power in this essence is kind of based on her husband's authority, of course. A lot of times you can see her sign her name, Mrs. Alexander Campbell, which is not that unusual at the time, but she, in her personal correspondence, she tended to sign her name S.H. Campbell. But in kind of official things, when she's writing articles, she was always Mrs. Alexander Campbell. And so she wielded that influence very adeptly. Now, here she is as an international author. I thought I'd give you a little flavor of this. She published in just about all the journals. The Christian Standard, the Christian Evangelist most often, which are the two of the most important ones. Not very often the Gospel Advocate. I haven't researched this yet, but I just haven't gotten into it yet, but I have a feeling it's because she didn't much care for David Lipscomb. He had cast a few aspersions on Alexander Campbell about his mental state a couple times that kind of offended her. So I think she didn't much care for him and may not have pursued much in the Gospel Advocate. But then I start finding her in British journals, including the British Millennial Harbinger, published by James Wallace in England. She would send things like news of the churches in the U.S. She'd report on her husband's health, and they would publish all her letters. Even more significantly, in the Christian Advocate, this is a little bit later in the 1880s. This one published in Edinburgh. She, and I called it British, but I should have just said the general, England and Scotland. And anyway, she actually debated women preaching with some of the British women in these publications, kind of back and forth. She's reading this, and she's like, I'm a little troubled by what they're doing. And definitely signed that letter, Mrs. Alexander Campbell. Then in Canadian journals, this one, Banner of the Faith, David Oliphant in Canada, in 1863... She sends in a letter and becomes, the journal ran, 8-9 years, I think. And she's the only female author named in the journal. There are a couple that say from a sister or, some anonymous ones. She's the only named one. And so clearly, and you can tell from the letter, she's corresponding with these men, throughout this international movement. They write to her about various things, and she writes back. Some of that is done to help her husband, basically, because he's got so many people correspond with, she takes over part of that, but a lot of it was on her own behalf as well. Here's the end, I just clipped out the end so you can see that, this one, she was S.H. Campbell. That was more typical before his death. After he died, she kind of assumed the mantle as his widow, kind of almost speaking for him in a couple ways. And so this, the British Millennial Harbinger, this is from 1857. Now, a little more about her behind the scenes, and particularly how she shaped institutional structure. This was a role that became a lot more evident in her later years. Like, after the death of her husband, her children were all at the house. Kind of like she had more time. And that's not unusual. A lot of the most influential women that went, and the most active women, were those who didn't have children or maybe were single, for obvious reasons. You know, there's a lot more work to do when you've got those responsibilities. So here are some examples of institutions and issues that she impacted. The American Christian Missionary Society, you know, forms in the 1840s. This was always often a controversial agency within the church. Well, she was very supportive of missionary societies, extremely supportive of them. And so she urged support of the American Christian Missionary Society for the Barclays, some of the earliest missionaries, and Mary Williams, who were both in Jerusalem, attempting to convert the Jews. She, in fact, initiated a letter-writing campaign along with Julia Barclay and Mary Burnett. Her husband, David S. Burnett, was the corresponding secretary of the American Christian Missionary Society. These three women, and a few others that they sometimes recruited, actually launched letter-writing campaigns in support of this to anybody. Like Tolbert Fanning, they tried to convert him real hard, apparently, to support. If you're familiar with him, he's one of the more vocal detractors of the Missionary Society. And she writes in her letter, several letters to Julia Barclay, about how frustrated she is that he won't change his mind. He's a little bit stubborn. Although she says it kind of nicely. She's not really complaining. She's like, I wish I could change his mind, but he's pretty fixed in his ideas. But I think their biggest success might have been they got a lot more support from Benjamin Franklin. And I don't know for sure if it was because he at least mellowed out in some criticism of the Missionary Society. He was the editor of the American Christian Review, a Northern Church of Christ publication, and a pretty influential one. And they helped moderate his views a little bit, I think. And so these women, I mean, you should see the letter. They wrote letters back and forth about all their strategy for how they were going to influence people. She would say how every time she met Tolbert Fanning, she talked to him about it, like trying to twist his arm, like, you really should support this organization. It's doing a lot of good. I found that really. So here's that behind the scenes. You know, you wouldn't see that. You wouldn't know that, except that we have her correspondence with Julia Barclay that was preserved. And then there's the Christian Women's Board of Missions, which founded in 1874. It's founded by this woman here. That's why I put her here, Caroline Peer, and a few other women as well. I included her gravestone because here, you know, what do they say on her gravestone? Organized Christian Women's Board of Missions. So that how important that was. And what Selena Campbell does, she publishes a lot of articles in its support. Again, signed Mrs. Alexander Campbell. Mm-hmm. So, you know, with that kind of subtle hint that maybe her husband would have done the same, were he still living, because it was formed long after her husband's death, or at least a decade after. And so, yeah, essentially she trades on her husband's name to win allies for the Christian Women's Board of Missions. And I'll have a little more to say about what she does in connection with that in a little bit. But the support of her name, did go a long way toward legitimizing that group. And it goes on to become one of the most successful women's missionary societies in the whole, because just about every denomination had them, every religious group. But the one in the Stone Campbell movement was among the most successful. And then she had a huge hand in Alexander Campbell's memoir. She commissions Robert Richardson to do it, gives him access to all Campbell's papers, probably was one of his sources as well, because she'd been known him for so long, and really probably influences Richardson's interpretation significantly of Alexander Campbell. And really, I mean, her goal is to shape his legacy in the churches. And there's another place she kind of exerts her influence there. And then I wanted to throw in there also that she, in many ways, was a female evangelist in some unique ways. And this really gets into that heart of the role that women did play, not one that's named, really. You wouldn't have called a woman at this time an evangelist, generally, and yet that is what they were. And I want to look at some of the ways she did that. One of the ways is through motherhood. If you read, I sometimes felt a little sorry for her children. I don't know how they viewed it, but a lot of her letters to them were all about, make sure you're not drinking and smoking, and make sure, you know, and a lot about their spiritual condition. I pray for you all the time, and got to think, I don't know how they felt about it. I get the sense that they were like, okay, Mom, just back off a little. So she's always writing to their children about their salvation. You can see in her letters to her friends, she's talking about when her children convert, you know, and how important that was to her, you know, that they were secure for eternity. So it's clear that that role of the mother evangelist was really important to her. And that was a key part. I mean, Alexander Campbell saw it that way, too. In fact, that's why he was such a champion of women's education. It's an issue that comes up prominently in the book I'm working on right now, is they wanted to educate women partly because they have this idea of we need to educate them so they can educate the next generation, convert them. And that's how you kept the church going, through, you know, women as mothers, bringing their children into the church. Now, she's also kind of a, what I would call a personal evangelist. I already said she opposed women preaching except, and this is her own words in a letter to her friend Julia, to the washerwoman at the tub, to the cook, and to my visitors in the parlor, and when in stagecoaches, on railways, on steamboats, indeed in the house of By the Way, you know, so as to enlist some in leading them to Jesus, that they might be saved from sin and its terrible consequences, as dear old Father Thomas Campbell well used to express it. And then she said, but, I kind of added a but, it's a little bit later in the letter, she said, I never found my way into the pulpit. It was not commanded, and she underlined that. So she thought there was a very strict line in what women should be doing, not publicly in the pulpit, but behind the scenes, have at it. You know, convert everyone. Clear example is her sister-in-law, Mary Bakewell. I feel kind of sorry for her, too, because she got a barrage of letters from Zena Campbell. Her brother, Theron, marries this woman who was not a part of the church, was not religious, as Zena Campbell put it. And she kept writing to her and writing to her about... Now, in a nice way, I should say, I don't think she really berated people. She was very gentle about it and said, I know that... You know, you are a very intelligent woman, and I enjoy the deep conversations we have. I just hope that you will consider, you know, I can't think of the exact words right now, but she was very gentle about it. And that may be why she was successful, because it looks like, we don't know directly if Mary Bakewell converted, but her and her husband would later house missionaries in their home and do a lot for the church, so it seems likely that she did. And then back to missions a little bit. I want to throw this in here because indirectly, she raised a lot of money for missions herself. In fact, she was the first woman to publicly raise money for missions that I have seen, anyway. Here is the article she published. I'll go back to that other slide in a little bit, but just to show you the article. It starts out, you know, an appeal to the sisterhood, you know, to my Christian sisters in common faith, you know, to whom this may come. And I won't read the whole thing to you, but it's an appeal on behalf of a woman named Mary Williams, who was probably one of the first female, if not the first female missionaries connected to the Stone Campbell movement, went to Jerusalem, opened a school for Jewish children, trying to convert them through education, which was a very common method at the time as a way to win converts. And this was in the 1850s. Mary Williams had been the teacher of Selena Campbell's children at Pleasant Hill Seminary, operated by P.S. Ball, which is one of the more prominent educational institutions for women in the Stone Campbell movement early on. So that's how Selena Campbell knew her. Mary Williams had met Alexander Campbell, converted, become a part of the movement, eventually going to Jerusalem. And she's raising money for her because the American Christian Missionary Society was chronically short of funds and just couldn't support her. And so Selena Campbell took it on herself, raised quite a bit of money, almost the entire support for Mary Williams. And near as I can tell, it's the first public appeal for women raising money for other women. And after that, at 70 years old, she becomes a state organizer for the West Virginia Christian Women's Board of Missions, so the state chapter of the Christian Women's Board of Missions. And what's significant about that is that was the second one. After, I guess they found it in, I think it's Illinois is the first one, and West Virginia is the second one. And that's because it's Lena Campbell. She gets out there, goes to the churches. Here, you guys found an organization at this church, this, you know, drums up all the support. And so she's key in helping that organization grow on so many levels, publicity-wise, you know, using her name, and then her own work, her own connections in making it happen. And I think these are the stories we don't know about, because this organization went on to send missionaries all over the world and to raise a lot of money and eventually to found organizations within the United States as well, helping to grow churches in almost every state. So that's why are you one of the most significant organizations in the history of the movement. Okay. All right, so in conclusion, I just mentioned a little bit about how can we see women then? Well, if our focus is only on who's in the pulpit and who has the title of elder, then we will not see what women have done. If that's all we see, we're not going to see women, for sure. So I couldn't stand up to you and say, oh yeah, women were the only key movers in the movement, you know, they shaped it so directly. Well, it's hard to say that because mostly the leadership was male, the public leadership. But invisibility does not negate leadership, it only hides it. And so I think if we open our eyes to a broad range of who contributes to the church's impact on the world, very quickly, we see an incredible partnership between female styles of leadership and male styles of leadership that together kind of build the church. And we couldn't have done it without either. But, right. All right. So I think I have a few minutes left for questions. I'll end it there so I can at least have a few minutes of questions. Is that right, Jerry? Go about six more minutes?
Maybe seven.
Maybe seven. All right.
Speak to her reaction to the son's death.
Oh, that is a very intriguing story. Yeah, the Campbells, you know, you always hope that there's going to be a son that's going to follow in the father's footsteps. Mm-hmm. And the one that they thought would was a son they named Wycliffe, after the Bible translator. And he really was the apple of her eye. Apparently, they were together all the time. Apparently, this was the son that memorized all the scripture, was very dynamic in personality. But I think at, 10 years old or so, 9 or 10, goes swimming in the creek and drowns near their house. Devastated her. Now, this was not an unusual occurrence for the era. I mean, women lost children frequently, unfortunately. You know, everybody lost children. But she took it really hard. Went into a tailspin depression. I remember reading... and a woman named Eliza Davies happened to stay with the family when this was going on, and I was reading her biography in the Library of Congress when I was a student at Georgetown, so I was sitting in the Library of Congress main reading room. I started crying. It was so sad. Apparently she would go out and swim in the creek looking for her dead son because she was just so distraught at him. And what brought her out of it, at least according to Eliza Davies, is that the death of her oldest daughter, who dies just after giving birth. And then the son dies too, and it's kind of like Selena Campbell says, okay, people need me, I got to get going. I can't do it anymore. But they tell stories about Alexander Campbell going out to find her and bringing her in, just sopping wet, and he's trying to comfort her. Because I should say, the life of a preacher's wife, he was gone when this happened. He was in England, in jail, really. So I can't believe him, I guess, on that one. But that's a whole other story, him being in jail. He returns, you know, to get a telegram when he gets on the American shores. And,
didn't they open a school there at the mansion as well? And who taught the children, and there were children besides their own who attended the school, who taught the children when he was gone?
Early on, this is what I've been trying to get more details about, because are you referring to the Bethany College or the earlier one, the Buffalo...
The mansion there.
Yeah, the Buffalo Seminary, I think it was
called. And they had a little schoolhouse to the right of the mansion.
Yeah, one thing I did determine is that there were women in that school. And so Alexander Campbell did let a few women in. Now, his intent was not to make them preachers, of course. That was the intent of training the male students. As far as who taught them, you know, I can't remember in that era if Jane, because his sister, Jane Campbell McKeever, was a very accomplished teacher. In fact, I chuckled when I read some descriptions of her teaching with Thomas Campbell. Together they opened an academy, and apparently, at least according to some people, Thomas Campbell is not a great teacher. Might have been a better preacher, but as a teacher, and that she was the one that was really popular, Jane McKeever. And it was in Kentucky, and Thomas Campbell wants to teach some of the slaves nearby and attempts to do so, gets in a lot of trouble, and it really offends him that he couldn't teach just anyone, you know, about the Bible. So he says he washed his hands of Kentucky and wanted to leave. And Jane McKeever wanted to stay. Of course, she wasn't Jane McKeever then. She's still Jane Campbell. So she wants to stay and continue operating the school, and he told her no. I always thought, oh, bummer lot of a woman. She was, you know, this young, a young woman, and so he wouldn't let her stay and operate the school. They forced her to go back to Virginia. But I don't know specifically, though, if she then taught when he was gone at that point. It's possible. But I don't know if you know. I haven't run across any references to that early era. It's hard to find information about that part. Only Richardson really talks about it much in the memoirs. There's just a little bit. Okay, I saw another hand.
Was Wycliffe, did it have anything to do with Wycliffe Bible Society that later came on?
Yeah, well, Wycliffe was a Bible translator.
Before that?
Jerry, help me. You're the church historian.
John Wycliffe gives us the English translation of the Bible. Campbell is so impressed with Wycliffe's influence in the world, he names his son for Wycliffe.
Oh.
But the Wycliffe Bible Translation Center is named for the man in 1200.
Oh. Yes, the original translator. Yeah.
And then the Women's Bible Missionary Society, didn't the men ultimately vote that it should all be one society with the end of the invocation.
Well, that's what I was actually just researching a few weeks ago in the files of the United Christian Missionary Society that was formed out of that. The idea was to combine efforts. You know, it was all about efficiency. We're duplicating our efforts because we have men's society, women's society. Why don't we just join it together? And women were guaranteed a certain number of seats on the board. And they conducted a whole study on whether it worked out for women a few years later and found out it really didn't. They kind of lost out. They were supposed to be equal, and then it didn't play out that way. So it really was an end of an era when the Christian Women's Board of Missions is not its own institution.
What is the name of your first book, and is it available in paperback?
Yes.
In the bookstore?
I don't know. Probably not. It's on Amazon.
Okay, and what's the name of it?
It's called The Life of Selena Campbell. And it was under my maiden name. So it's Loretta Long then. So if you're looking for it.
Last question, one more minute. Who was it that inspired you to work on Selena Campbell? I've never asked you that.
Oh. Well, indirectly, I would say it's someone in the audience. See David Barrett back there? He was my professor for a research seminar when I was a history major here. And I was looking for a topic, couldn't find anything. I was trying looking for guidance. I knew I liked religion. And he said, hey, you should study something about women. Because there's so much to do with that. This was in the early 90s, you know, when it really was, you know, a growth area. Still is, really. And that got me thinking, oh... And so eventually I applied. And then I, at the same time, was becoming more a part of the Churches of Christ while I was here. Because I'd been in the Christian churches when I grew up. Got more involved in the Churches of Christ. And then by the time I had to write a PhD dissertation, it all came together. And I wanted to write about women in the Churches of Christ. And initially I thought, oh, well, there's probably not going to be a lot. So I may have to write about a group of women in order to try to make it, in order to make it work. Like sources in particular. Yeah, not a lot of women too, but not a lot of sources. But then it turns out her... brother's papers were preserved in Virginia, which have a lot of letters from her. Her correspondence with Julia Barclay's at the Disciples of Christ Historical Society. And then the Campbell family papers are in Bethany. So there are three different fairly sizable paper collections with letters from and to her that really helped me reconstruct her life. And so once I figured out there was that much information, it almost wrote itself. Yeah, there's so much that I could say.
This was wonderful. Let's thank Laurie.